Welcome to the China in the World podcast, a series of discussions examining China's foreign policy and shifting engagement with the world. Brought to you by the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing and hosted by Paul Manning.
Welcome everyone to the first panel of the 2021 to 2022 Carnegie Global Dialogue Series. My name is Paul Hanley. I'm the director of the Carnegie Center in Beijing, and I'm glad to be joined today by Darshana Barua and Dr. Han Hua. For those of you who are unfamiliar with our Carnegie Global Dialogue Series, this is our 10th year hosting the series, and it is a series of panel discussions examining China's evolving foreign policy and international role from the perspective of Carnegie scholars at each of our global centers. You'll be able to find replays of our dialogue today and all of our previous Carnegie Global Dialogues on our website, the China in the World podcast website, which is a series of discussions that I host with Chinese international experts brought to you from our center in Beijing. Our aim is to help educate and promote a greater understanding of the transformational issues surrounding China's shifting role in the world. We have discussed, and we're going to discuss today, issues related to Chinese foreign policy, China's international role, and everything else involving China's relations with the world. In our podcast, we've recorded over 150 episodes to date, and I'd encourage folks to take a listen. Let me, for our discussions today, let me introduce our two expert panelists, Darshana Barua and Dr. Han Hua. Darshana is an associate fellow with the Carnegie South Asia program at Carnegie India, where she leads a new initiative called the Indian Ocean Initiative. Her research with Carnegie focuses primarily on maritime security in Asia and the role of the Indian Navy in the Indo-Pacific, as well as strategic implications of China's connectivity and infrastructure projects and strategic partnerships. In 2018, Darshana served as a visiting fellow at the Japan Institute of International Affairs. That same year, she was named as the UK's Next Generation Foreign and Security Policy Scholar for 2017 by the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Prior to joining Carnegie, Darshana was an associate editor at the South China Sea Monitor at the Observer Research Foundation's Maritime Security Initiative. Thank you very much, Darshana, for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Paul. Looking forward to the discussion.
Dr. Han Hua is back by popular demand. Han Hua joined us last year for our Carnegie Global Dialogue, and we're delighted to have her back. She is a professor and director of the Center for Arms Control and Disarmament at the School of International Studies in Beijing University. We're glad to have her back. She teaches courses at Peking University in International Relations and South Asia and International Arms Control. She's been a visiting researcher at Harvard's Belfer Center, also the School of International Affairs at Georgia Institute of Technology, and SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute in Sweden. She has led programs and projects on regional nuclear nonproliferation, confidence building measures, and nuclear disarmament. We're very glad to have you back, Dr. Han Hua. Thank you for joining us today.
Really, my great pleasure. I'm glad to see you all.
Before we kick off our discussion, just very quickly, a couple of housekeeping items. We do want to give the audience an opportunity to ask questions of our experts. And to do so, you would use our YouTube chat. Second, we will be posting the episode to our China in the World podcast platform, as I mentioned, and you'll be able to listen to the recording there. We will also post a video recording on YouTube. So with that, let's kick off our discussion. The China-India relationship, as our experts well know, has become increasingly characterized by distrust. In addition to a nearly 2-year long standoff in Eastern Ladakh, and the recent breakdown in border dispute negotiations, COVID-19 has further strained the relationship. It's pushed India and China to reduce people-to-people flows between the two countries. Economic ties have suffered as well. Limits have been placed on Chinese investment in Indian tech companies, and bans on Chinese mobile apps have also been put in place. Meanwhile, India has made significant moves in its international security relationships. Of course, we have seen the partnering that India has, the backing of the Quad initiative, which is met at the leader level. India has also bolstered defense partnerships with Australia and Japan, and it's becoming a more active security actor in the Indo-Pacific. We kind of dive into whether China and India will be able to, through some of this tension, and find common ground, and what the fraught relationship between the two nations mean for the United States. I want to give both of you a chance to kind of give us your sense of where China-India relations stand today. And I'll ask both of you that question. And also, where, if, in your response, where, in your view, do you think China and India's interests converge, and where do they diverge? And I will start with Darshana.
Thank you, Paul. Really great to be here with Professor Han, and I really look forward to this conversation. I'll actually maybe take your second question first in terms of what are the convergences and what are the differences between China and India, because it has definitely been interesting to watch the trajectory of the relationship especially since the current government came to power. And they came to power with I think, an idea, or at least an interest in smoothing out relationship with China, in the sense that acknowledging there will be competition, there will be areas of friction because of the border dispute. It's not that they inherited a border that didn't have any issues, but also realizing that there is a need to perhaps coexist and cooperate, and taking away the narrative of strategic competition, I guess, guiding the relationship. And the interest, I think, converge in a way that India and China both seek to have a say, bigger say, in the new security architecture that is coming up in the region. And I think the interests diverge in the format of that architecture and what role each will play in it, or perhaps the approach to it. And that's how I see in the interest, because even in 2018, after the Doklam incident, Prime Minister Modi, when he spoke at Shangri-La Dialogue, he was still talking about, he was advocating for an Asia of cooperation, you know, the Asian brotherhood that India and China and India and its Asian partners and neighbors need to work together in acknowledging contest, but not leading into conflict. So there was, and the leaders also have met almost about 18 times in the last 6 years, which should show that there was an interest to perhaps find commonality and convergences, given India's own interest and given India's own problems on the western border with Pakistan. I think this government was particularly interested in moving the narrative from its eastern border with China away from one that is dominated by conflict and tension. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened, where I think the interest in carving out a path for themselves in the region diverged, because I guess it's seen as stepping on each other's toes that has led to perhaps where we are today. And that's where the interests diverge, even if both perhaps seek in changing a system today that reflects their views and perceptions better than it did in the era immediately after 1945.
Thank you very much, Darshana. So, you know, unfortunate in a sense, because it the way you describe it, this is not the vision that Indian leaders had for the relationship. They set out, despite competition and friction, to try to put the relationship on more solid footing. But it sounds like events have not allowed for that to take place. And in a sense, not find that commonality and convergence that you describe Indian leaders were looking for. Let me turn now to Dr. Hanwha. And, you know, in addition to giving your sense of where relations stand and the convergences and the divergences, you know, feel free to respond to anything that you've heard from Darshana.
Thank you very much. I think maybe the recent so-called distrust between the two countries, especially after the standoff last year in west sector of the border, really gave the image, the bad image.
Seems like we may have lost Dr. Hanwha. Oh, I see her coming back in. Let me give her 1 second.
So now
we've got you back.
Okay, great. So I think the border standoff really made the picture look darker than expected. So I would like to emphasize the convergent side of the relationship more than the dark side or the divergence. Because the two countries actually have so many interests in common. For example, especially when we talk political and economic aspect in the international order. For example, when we talk about the multilateral world, or especially when we talk about the international or global governance, we really see some common interests inside this. When they talk about this issue, international issues, they say. For example, they talk about how the financial system, international financial system should be, and also the trade regime should be. When they talk about this, they can find common languages. And also we have already established quite a number of institutions where they can cooperate each other. For example, the BRICS, especially in the emerging economies can cooperate under the BRICS, forum, really give us some common ground to talk about economic order. And also we can talk about AIIB. When they talk about the infrastructure build up among the regions, especially in Asia, they really put the money in the regional pool where they can really get the investment to different countries. Especially when we talk about the economic development is a priority for most of the region, the countries in the region. And also recently, India was included in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where maybe we can talk about anti-terrorism and other issues where they all have concerns. So, but I especially I want to emphasize is a recent the COP 26 where the people talk about how China and India in the final drawing of the final documents, they took quite a common stand on the how they say the four the core power, for example, how they want to phrase the sentences in the final documents. Having said so, I know there are some really emerging flashpoints in the internet the bilateral relations, especially from the security perspective or strategic dimension. They talk about the border newly standoffs. and the different understanding about how they see each other's role in the Indian Ocean. And also the Chinese BRI really caused some concerns from Indian side, especially when they talk about maybe China's increasing influence in the backyard or the traditional sphere of influence of India, especially when they talk about South Asia. So recognizing all the common interests or conflicting interests, I think maybe where we can try to put the relationship back to the bright side of the story or the picture. That's the big issue for both countries.
Thank you, Hanhua. And you know, it's interesting. I hear you saying that in a sense, the standoff at the border and the clashes at the border have really kind of, in a sense, overwhelmed the relationship, because there are a lot more, in your view, areas of commonality and alignment. And you mentioned many of the organizations, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the BRICS organization that China and India participate in together. And your sense is that on global governance, especially in the economic and financial space, there's actually a lot of alignment between India and China, and also on climate, but that is now overwhelmed by the security and strategic issues related to the border clash. Also concerns over the Belt and Road Initiative, which have been there for some time, and also the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which I know is a major issue with the Indian government as well. Because of the border dispute, of course, the negative aspects of the India-China relationship are more emphasized. You have spoken previously about India's shifting alignment toward the United States because of intensified geopolitical competition in the Indo-Pacific region. Some have argued that China will leverage India's increasing alignment with the Quad and the U.S. as a pretext to establish a stronger maritime security posture in the Indo-Pacific, to strengthen its strategic partnership with Pakistan, for example, which could potentially inflame ties with India even further. I'm interested in how you see that possibility, but also, as you look at the Biden administration, its policies in the first year in office, its desire to really move forward in an assertive way with the Quad, how that has affected the relationship between China and India. How has the Biden administration coming into office with its new policies affected that China-India dimension? And I'll ask Darshan, I'll ask Hanhua to start, and then I will ask Darshana to respond.
Thank you, Paul. I think there's a disappointment in the beginning when President Biden took office in the White House, because the Quad actually was adopted as a national policy during Trump administration when the foreign ministers met each other among the four countries at the sideline of UN Assembly in 2017. So since then, the Quad has been more formalized or the institutionalized, and maybe some people to talk about, especially among the Chinese, they talk about maybe it's a more like a security correlation, if not alignment. So that's really gave us some kind of a warning sign. for the analysts in China, especially when they talk about the free and open navigation along the Indo-Pacific region, as the and also the rule-based order in this region, and some coercion, economic coercion in this country. So all those, notions are not, maybe not mention China in the name, but still we know clearly people talk about it's a kind of anti-China or the check on China's rise in this region. That's really gave us some kind of a warning. But actually, when Biden came into power, we thought maybe Biden talk about the three dimensions in the Sino-American relations: rivalry, competition, and cooperation. So maybe cooperation is more what they want to say, but unfortunately, Biden, take the legacy of Trump administration when they talk about the strategy in the Indo-Pacific region, especially when they talk about the Quad. And the Quad, Biden administration really make a new progress. For example, the first visual and the first in-person summit meetings in March and also in recent months. And the first communique came out even without a name China in the document, but still the tone we can see between the lines, we still think it's a kind of a hostile toward China. And also the military exercise, strong military exercise conducted in this region, is a kind of really, we think, really make the periphery of China, especially maritime domain, is more complicated as we see. And when we talk about India in the beginning, India was a little bit hesitated to participate a kind of a formal alignment arrangement with the other three countries. But because of the standoffs along the border, it make India more willingness to really say, choosing side in this competition of among the great power competition. That's really make Chinese feel maybe it's a sad story for the Indian China relationship.
Thank you, Dr. Han Hua. Darshana, same question to you, but India has had typically been reluctant to embrace the Quad, too fully because of its desire to maintain a constructive relationship with China. I think many assess that the experiences with the border clashes with China along the border had shifted India's calculus. And we see a more robust engagement by Indian leaders in the Quad. And I want to get a sense from you, is there still good, strong support for the Quad going forward? And how have you seen or how do you assess China's reaction to India's involvement in the Quad? Is this, being used as a pretext by China to strengthen its maritime security posture in the region and its partnership with Pakistan? And how do you see this situation?
Thank you, Paul. A couple of things in this. I think India's also strengthening its own kind of maritime security and engagements in the region. And what you posed in terms of that, would China use that India getting closer to its Western allies or through permissions such as the Quad, would leverage it to perhaps pursue or strengthen its own relationships in the region. But I think for India, it was kind of probably on the opposite in the sense is the realization that whether India joins Quad or not, China is going to do what it requires to secure its maritime interests. Majority of China's energy supplies to the goes through the Indian Ocean region. It's from the Persian Gulf. It very much has to transit the Indian Ocean region. So regardless of what India does or does not do, I think from a China perspective, it is about if it's about protection of sea lanes of communication, if it's about protecting China's energy interests, if it's about protecting China's economic interests, China would have to be present in the Indian Ocean region. And no matter what India does, that interest is not going to be shaped, right? Because that is linked to China's larger global ambitions or national interests. Its energy routes are dependent on that. Now, the problem has been, how does that impact the China-India relationship? Because there is already an ongoing standoff at the border. India's always realized that, of course, there's an issue at the continental border. So you have the China competition or a threat or however you frame it, that is limited to the continental border. India has always enjoyed a more advantageous position at sea, and China coming into the Indian Ocean region now perhaps, you know, brings that continental competition out to sea. What role does India play if China is able to perhaps, solidify or strengthen its own partnerships in the region? And I think that is something that will play out. And for India, Indonesia looks at the entire Indian Ocean region as its area of responsibility. So that goes from the eastern coast of Africa to the Straits of Malacca. So it very much includes the energy trade routes that are going between China and the Middle East. I think as far as Quad is concerned, you're absolutely right. I agree with Professor Han and you what he said also is that India has been reluctant initially. In fact, in 2018, when Prime Minister Modi spoke at the Shangri-La dialogue, which is largely considered to be sort of Delhi's outlining of what its Indo-Pacific strategies are, he very specifically mentioned that, you know, that do not take India's friendships with the West as alliances of containment. And that was targeted at China to say that, you know, because we work with other countries, it's not that we will work toward containing China. And that narrative has definitely shifted since the last year. I don't think so. Biden's emphasis on the Quad has impacted India-China relationship. I think India-China relationship has an impact on the Quad. Because of where the border is, there's a more willingness from China. In that point converges or conflicts with China's interests, it does become a competition in a sense. Indian Navy is also the least funded armed forces the service of the armed forces. It only gets 14% of the defense budget because the army gets the majority of it, which is focused on the continental border. So the only way India can respond to a challenge at sea is through partnerships. And that's why you will see more and more happening between India and its partners at sea, because that is the only way at this point that India can respond to a growing challenge, a growing competition that's emerging at sea.
That is that's very interesting, Darshana. Thank you for that. And it's remarkable how much has shifted in a short time. You mentioned the Shangri-La dialogue and Prime Minister Modi's comments. That was just 3 years ago. A lot seems to have shifted given the border clashes. And I think we should really kind of dive deep into that issue before moving on, because it seems to have impacted and affected so much, not just India-China relations, but broader regional dynamics. And it seems that this is an issue really where the two sides should focus. Despite initial efforts to try to mend relations after the standoff and the border skirmishes in eastern Ladakh, there were two informal summits between Xi and Modi over the past few years. The border dispute, however, continues to worsen. And it's culminating in a deadly clash that broke out in June of 2020, resulting in deaths of numerous Indian soldiers. There's been a lot of finger pointing going on in Beijing and New Delhi over who is to blame for the conflict. And the process of disengagement has begun along certain sections of the border. Let's just talk for a few minutes about this particular issue. And, you know, how do each of you see the developments along the China-India border? How do you expect this issue to evolve? And what is required really to try to find a way through diplomacy or other means to get by this issue so that it does not cause such a significantly negative impact on the relationship? Let me start with you, Darshana.
Thanks, Paul. All the conversations so far has, of course, like you said, has highlighted the impact that the border clash has had on the relationship. And the biggest aspect of the border clash is the way it has changed the public opinion domestically in India. The loss of Indian lives, you know, the soldiers, the 20 soldiers that died at the clash, it in a way unified the domestic voice vis-a-vis India's competition with China. Up until that, there was very much the conversation and debate over China domestically, at least, was pretty much divided. Everybody was not convinced that India should be doing things that antagonize China. Not everybody was in favor of a more robust partnership with US and its partners. Not everybody was convinced that, you know, that India should take on such a narrative of strategic competition with China, simply because it was based on questions of resources, it was based on questions of capital, it was based on questions of the whole Asian Brotherhood and a series of factors. But I think the loss of life at the border and the way it happened has really changed the domestic mood and the domestic conversation, the public opinion on China. So even if the government were to take a few steps back and to say that, okay, you know, we would manage this XYZ, it has a domestic narrative that it needs to address. And in that, you cannot seem as a country that has lost sovereign territory to China. You cannot seem as a country who doesn't have the power or the capacity to respond to a neighbor's incident that has led to loss of military life, like soldiers' life. So it shapes India's, it not only impacts the domestic conversation, but it also impacts the government's own narrative of what it's trying to project to its population, which is to say India is going to be, is a leading power. India wants to be a leading power. It's a regional player. It's a security provider. It's a security player. If you cannot secure your own borders, do you have the capacity to offer that security to your friends and partners in the region? So it does play out at the regional aspect as well. So I think the border dispute is something that is going to be, especially this one, because this was such a, initially there was this conversation that Doklam would change a lot of the things in the India-China relationship. But like I pointed out, even after the Doklam incident the next year, Modi did get on stage and say, we are not looking for alliances of containment. So there was still an understanding or at least an interest to see how this can be managed. The loss of life at the border has really changed the domestic conversation. Now there is a unified voice in identifying China as an adversary, as a competition, as a threat, and then figuring out what is it that India needs to do, given its capital constraints, given its resource constraint, to secure its interest and protect it from kind of Chinese incursion. So I think that will also play out at the border, how that disengagement goes out, the standoff continues. Perhaps we will not see skirmishes in the long run, but it's also a question in terms of how it plays into China's own conversation on protecting sovereign territory, the whole conversation, whether it is in the South China Sea or whether it is in the border, which is to say this is China's territorial, part of China's territory. And I don't think that that's limited to China, it's any country. If domestically you're saying this land belongs to China and it's part of your sovereign territory, you would have to protect it. So how would the disengagement work if both sides would have to play to the domestic kind of audience saying that this, we haven't lost land and we are able to protect our sovereign territory? So I'm not sure how this is going to work out in terms of the disengagement. There has already been 11 rounds of military talks, but I suppose the standoff will continue. It will continue to shape the relationship and also India's own collaborations with larger countries.
Darshana, one quick follow-up question. You know, you point out that after Doklam, you know, the two sides, the two leaders met. You know, there was an attempt to try to move beyond the issue. I remember when the two leaders, Xi and Modi, met in Wuhan, and following that meeting, there was a lot of talk about the Wuhan spirit, which was really an attempt to kind of put major disagreements aside and try to work on areas where there was potential for cooperation. Do you see that, you know, anytime soon coming out of these most recent border clashes, or do you expect that it will take much more time to get to a place where India and China were after Doklam?
I do think it'll take a little bit more time because the whole Wuhan spirit or Wuhan reset also sort of blew back on the government's face, because there was this whole conversation that whatever happened to the Wuhan spirit, if you had such an understanding with China, how did something like Ladakh happen? And it happened within the government's kind of, you know, the second term, it came into second term. India has also taken very strong stance with surgical strikes in 2016 against Pakistan. So is it a question that India can perhaps take stronger military measures against a country it considers smaller than or weaker than itself, but it can't actually stand up to a neighbor which is in, you know, in every sense of the term, probably bigger or is an actual threat? So I think the fact that Ladakh happened after the Wuhan reset, which was supposed to help the two countries move forward from Doklam, was the part that pushed the line within the bureaucracy that perhaps conversations is that the problem is something else. It's not just limited to perhaps India and China. It is larger in terms of what China seeks to do in the region, what India seeks to do in the region. And I do see, I do not see the government coming to the table in a way that they did in the Wuhan spirit in the near future, in the next couple of months. Depends how the talks go, depends how the disengagements go. And I think government will also be careful to not have something, because the Ladakh issue was embarrassing after having, you know, you coming to the table, taking a chance and saying, we're going to reset this, we're going to figure out a way, and it still happened. And something like that happens a third time, I think it will be difficult for the country to actually, the government, the Modi government, to come up and say that it takes these incursions seriously and it has the capacity to do something about it.
Interesting. Very interesting. Thank you. Dr. Hanhua, how do Chinese scholars and experts view the developments on the China-Indian border? And what's your sense on how to move beyond? How will this evolve? And what's required to really try to, at some point, get beyond this?
I think it's a very unfortunate development, as you said. After Doklam, they experienced a reset of the relationship between the two leaders. But the problem is that I am a little bit pessimistic, because I think after the second term of a Modi government, really, if you look at the manifesto of the BJP's during the two campaigns, you can say some areas or some, aims of the party really made the issues as some flashpoints for the bilateral relationship. For example, the domestic, the re-legitimize of the strengthening of control of Kashmir, and the redraw the territory of this area, and also some common, the more nationalist agenda under BJP control, especially after the overwhelming victory in the parliament. All those really make the decision making in India is really problematic for us for the bilateral relationship. And also the pandemic really made the situation even more tense because the support rate during the pandemic, as the expression in India, really make the support rate of Modi declined. Even now, the support rate is coming back a bit, but still, if you're really looking forward to a new election in the coming year, in the coming years, you have to think about the support rate and the electoral effect of the relationship with stronger neighbors, as you, as our speaker just said, because I think Modi came to power as in a kind of a realm of strongman, especially in terms of security or anti-terrorism. So the territory disputes with China really gave another opportunity for a strongman to say no to a threat. If you talk about the recent, discourse of the high-ranking military officer talking about the threat perception. But I think one thing is encouraging thing for me is that even the failure of the 13th round of commander level, the military talks, they still talk, agree, both sides agree to maintain communication between the two militaries and stability along the border. Even we have seen the upgrading of the advanced equipment, military equipment along the border, the more troops from especially from Indian side to the border. That should really show determination to stay through the winters, the harsh winter environment. So that maybe make the border stand up sustained through some months at least. And also the economic and the other social problem inside India also make the issue more kind of a sign to say as the speaker just said, it's a kind of the new momentum among the ordinary Indians. They talk about how popularity of the government should be, right? That's really make me to feel a little bit disappointed when they talk about the way out of the stalemate.
Thank you, Dr. Hanhua. I do want to talk about economics and technology before we close, but we've got some questions in the security strategy, the strategic space that I want to cover first. First to Darshana, listener has asked about China's more assertive posture in the South China Sea, more assertive claims, enforcement or movement towards its claims in the South China Sea, the island building campaign, the tension that's taken place in the South China Sea has been an issue between the US and China and increasingly an issue with China and its regional neighbors. How does this South China Sea, how do these South China Sea tensions affect India's maritime security strategy? Great question for you, given your expertise on maritime security. Second question in the security realm is the issue of AUKUS. Neither, and this, of course, is the security arrangement between the UK, Australia, and the United States. And of course, that includes Australia buying building nuclear subs with U.S. Nuclear technology. Neither China or India are directly involved in this agreement, but it is similar, of course, to another ad hoc arrangement like the Quad. But how do Indian leaders view AUKUS? Do they see it as a positive, or are they do they see it maybe as a snub, since the U.S. has not really been willing to share nuclear sub technology in the past? And then I'll ask Hanhua a little bit about AUKUS after your initial responses, Darshana.
Thank you, Paul. Really heavy questions, but on the maritime strategy part of it, in fact, as someone who kind of, you know, watches India's maritime trajectory and engagements, I didn't think India actually took notice of what was going on in the South China Sea in time enough. India did not necessarily think that what was happening in the South China Sea was going to spill over into the Indian Ocean region, because it was very confident about its own capabilities in the Indian Ocean region and genuinely thought that the South China Sea issues were bilateral issues and sovereign, you know, disputes, territorial disputes that have lasted for a long time. But India's maritime strategy and security has been impacted with more new players coming into the Indian Ocean region, which by definition has, to a great extent, has been China. When China docked the submarines for the first time in Sri Lanka in 2014, I think that was the first space probably when red flags went up in Delhi, because, you know, that was Chinese assets coming into a region where they had not been before, which means India now needs to have the capability to detect it, follow it, and respond to it in case there is a crisis. So it increased its own requirement to strengthen its own capabilities, whether it's through partnerships, whether it is by itself, but to be able to ready for these changes. So over time, you have seen the Indian Navy place a great deal of emphasis on maritime domain awareness, which is essentially to be aware of what's going on at sea. And in that, underwater movements, whether it is submarines or, you know, whether it is on even from fish, actually on surface, fishing vessels, scientific vessels, what is happening in the Indian Ocean region has really impacted India's view of the region and how it needs to work more with partnerships. And I genuinely, and I wrote a paper on it for Carnegie, was India looking at the concept of the Indo-Pacific as a theater of opportunities, because it provides India the opportunity through partnerships to address these new challenges that it did not foresee in its region. It did not see a China docking in Sri Lanka. It did not see a China increasing its partnerships with Maldives. It did not see, you know, the Djibouti base coming up in the Indian Ocean region. So for all of this, it was new and emerging new challenges, or what these developments would have an impact on the region. And I think that's why Indo-Pacific has provided a larger canvas for India to build on its partnerships to address on these issues. I just want to just note here that I don't mean to say that what China is doing is wrong, or it's imposing its kind of ideas or values in the region. I think what China is doing is what any country with ambitions of being a global leader or a maritime power would do. You need to protect your sea lanes of communication. So you would have to go out there and protect it. And to be able to protect it, you need bases, you need facilities, you need partnerships. So I wouldn't say what China is doing is directed at India. I would say what China is doing, it is in consensus with its outlining of what its own national interest and maritime interests are. It just so happens that it collides with India's own interests, and it's, you know, how India looks at the partnerships. A second part of it, that's it, and this is becoming a problem in Delhi as well, where it is seen that China imposing unmanageable projects on smaller island nations, whether Sri Lanka, Maldives, and others, But I think from my point of view, it's also the countries welcoming a larger Chinese presence, because perhaps India has not been able to address the challenges that came up in the last 30 years. So it actually increases India's maritime strategy on different folds. It increases its need to do more on the strategic and military side of it, but also non-traditional security side of it, whether it's fishing vessels, whether it's scientific missions, whether it's hydrography missions. So India is likely to do more and more in the Indian Ocean region to protect its interests and to make sure that it maintains its advantages vis-a-vis new players in the Indian Ocean region. On the question of AUKUS, Indian leaders didn't really, there was not much. The only questions posed to them was, you know, if India saw AUKUS as a snub to the Quad because India was not part of it. But I think India's foreign policy and engagements have reached that level of understanding with its partners that it does not feel snubbed just because it's not part of a coalition, because India understands that it does not have the kind of treaty alliances that Australia, US, and UK does. So it's not possible to exchange or gain that level of technology. It does understand that now. I think we have come forward from move forward from the mistrust of the 70s when India-US relationship was particularly tense. On the issue of course, India would love to have this technology, but on this issue, I think India is very comfortable getting it elsewhere. So I see Delhi taking this as an opportunity to start conversations with France and say that, well, if France feels snubbed about it and if it is willing to share the technology, well, they have a buyer in India. So I think India would, this is the part where it frames a strategic autonomy, that is that it does not need to rely or cater its all of its defense needs and interests on to one, two, or three partners, but perhaps do it across its key partners. And France is a key partner for India, especially in the Indian Ocean region, as they are more present there than perhaps the United States. So the Indian, I don't see the Indian political leader looking at AUKUS as a snub or sidelining India. In fact, I think it is in some level welcome, because the Indian Navy's interest now is on anti-submarine warfare and the ability to perhaps respond to it, respond to a growing Chinese submarine fleet. And if India cannot respond to it, it definitely has become more comfortable in welcoming other partners who get to it.
Great, thank you so much. You mentioned a paper that you had recently published, and we have a viewer that's asking what that paper is. Was it India's maritime engagements with its European partners, or is it a different paper that you're referring to?
It's a different paper. It's called India. India and the Indo-Pacific Theater of Opportunity. It should be there on the Carnegie Endowment page.
Great, great. One of our viewers asked about it. Hanhua, feel free to respond to anything that Darshana just talked about in terms of AUKUS or India's maritime security initiatives. But I do have a question from a viewer on something that you had previously mentioned about China and India's similar positions at COP26, which just concluded in Glasgow. I think you had talked about India and China had actually aligned on pushing back on phasing down coal instead of phasing it out, and agreed in that area. And the question from our viewer, why do China and India have alignment on this issue? And how do they expect to accelerate decarbonization without more ambitious efforts to phase out coal consumption?
Let me answer, respond to the speakers talking about the AUKUS.
Yeah, sure.
And I think in China, they label that there's a alignment system under Biden administration, or maybe Trump administration, 3, 4, 5. AUKUS, 3 countries. 4 countries, the Quad, and 5 countries, 5 eyes, intelligence cooperation. So 3, 4, 5. not very popular among the Chinese, but they say the different functions and different kind of correlations, levels of correlations. It's a kind of a very special kind of form of the format of the network of the alignment system of the United States falls in this region. But Aux shares some very high ranking technology information or technology of the submarine, the nuclear driven submarine technology. But the problem is, for me, is that I still cannot fully understand the rationale behind this decision making, because the sharing the technology is not going to happen immediately after the form of the Aux, but maybe transfer all the cell of this technology, all the submarine is in at least maybe 10 years. So in 10 years, what's going to be look like in this region? The nuclear-driven submarine, a nuclear submarine still is a core part of the combat capability or the deterrence initiative is a kind of a core part of the deterrence initiative. I'm not so sure, but a very interesting movement. But it really gave me some kind of impression in this region. The alignment system is networking as well as a hierarchy rather than anarchy. So it is my impression on that. And also about the climate change. I think the cooperation between China and India has been there for almost all the occasions of climate change negotiations or the forums, because they share the common interest of development, and they cannot reach the carbon neutral immediately. So we still need to use a coal, a fossil energy. So the differentiative and the common interest is still the common ground for the two countries. And they know it's a hard work. And they still think maybe the Western or advanced countries should transfer some technologies and or maybe financial support to the developing countries. Maybe not China, single country, but as a whole, the developing countries' interests are there.
Dr. Hanhua, thank you. And I think, unfortunately, that you're going to get the last word. We have come up on our time, and I know my colleague Angie Chuen will be telling me it's time and ringing a bell in short order. And I do want to take a minute before we close to thank both of you very much for a terrific discussion. We will save the economic questions for later. Hopefully, we'll have an opportunity to bring you back. But I want to thank both of you for joining the discussion and for your candid and insightful perspectives. And I want to thank everybody who joined us to watch today. Hope you enjoyed the discussion and the opportunity to ask the experts, Darshana and Dr. Hanhua, questions. I encourage you to please check out our website for more of our research. And if you have not already, subscribe to the China in the World podcast, where you can hear this discussion replayed. And also over 150 other discussion with experts from China and the international community. have a wonderful week and stay safe. And thank you again, Darshana and Dr. Han Hua.
Thank you, Paul.